Thanks for joining us. I'm Frank Sesno, host of Planet Forward, which you can find at planetforward.org. But I'm sitting in for Diane Rehm today. She's on vacation, and I'm delighted to be with you. Most people know of Shaker Society through its simple but beautifully made furniture. Few realize the religious sect was once at the center of a controversial divorce and custody battle that challenged some of the country's most fundamental beliefs: religious freedom, feminine virtue, and the sanctity of marriage. Well, in a new book, author Ilyan Wu tells the story of one early 19th century mother's struggle against her husband and the Shakers to reclaim her children and her identity. It is titled The Great Divorce. And author Ilyan Wu joins me in the studio. It's great to see you.
It's great to see you, too.
Thanks for being here. The actual title is The Great Divorce, A 19th Century Mother's Extraordinary Fight Against Her Husband, the Shakers, and Her Times.
Yes.
Who's it about?
Well, on the most basic level, I suppose, it is about this 19th century mother.
What was her name?
Eunice Chapman.
Eunice Chapman.
Eunice Holly Chapman is her full name.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, as the title says, about her relentless pursuit of her missing children.
So tell us about Eunice, where she came from, what she was about, what captivated you about her, because you've dedicated more than a few years to dig into her past.
Yeah, definitely a lot of years. Yes, well, she was a native of Bridgeport, Connecticut, and she moved to Durham, New York in at the turn of the around 1800. And it was there that she met and married this man, James Chapman, who was to become the bane of her existence for a number of years. Now, I came across Eunice Chapman, I discovered her, I suppose, through her narratives, through these sensational stories that she wrote in support of her extraordinary legislative case.
Sensational stories. What were her sensational stories?
Yes. These are, well, you know, this was actually quite unusual for her to be doing this kind of writing at the time. This was before the age of the penny press, when it was pretty inexpensive to be able to produce these kind of things. And she took it upon herself to write basically tell-alls about her experiences with the Shakers, you know, portraying them as villains, as kidnappers, as captors. And these are the stories that really persuaded the American public, I think, to tune into her story.
Let's step back and set the stage here for a minute,
yes.
Okay? It's the early 1800s,
mm-hmm.
and Eunice obviously is a woman in this country who gets married. In the early 1800s, as a woman who gets married, you basically cease to exist as a legal individual entity. Is that not correct?
Exactly.
So what does that mean? What happens to you when you get married?
Well, the term for this covering up of your legal identity as a woman is called coverture. And from the moment a woman marries in this period, she becomes civilly dead.
That's actually a term.
It's a term that was used actually in the 1848 Seneca Falls convention, and it was used actually earlier as well. But it's civilly dead. It means that she has no rights to property apart from her husband. She can't make her own will, sign any other contract on her own, and she's really bound to her husband in all ways.
She has no legal standing as an individual.
Yeah.
All right, so she marries this guy, and then what happens? Well, first of all, tell us a little bit about him, because he's a little colorful in his own right.
Yes, well, he was about 15 years her senior, and he found her immediately attractive.
She was 26, right?
She was 26.
Which was considered old to be available at the time.
Exactly.
A spinster, you called her.
She was heading there
fast. A 26-year-old spinster. It's kind of hard to put your brain around that today.
It is. I mean, the age of marriage is so much later now, but back then, I mean, she had two older sisters who were already married and had a number of children, and these were sisters who were just a year or two older than she was. So, but her situation was affected by the fact that her family was in financial trouble. So she comes to Durham, New York. This is a good place for her to find a man. I mean, there are lots of people coming through, a lot of people headed west, and this man, James Chapman, 15 years older than she is. She does not find him very attractive. He has a child already. And for 2 years, she basically puts him off. And finally, I mean, this is when she's 26 now and her options are quite limited. She decides, all right, I'll just take him as he is.
And they then have three children.
Three children.
Quickly.
Yes.
And then what happens?
And the marriage just fell apart. If you were to ask him, he would say it's because she turns out to be this terrible shrew. If you were to ask her, it's because he was an alcoholic as well as an abusive husband.
And he then leaves the scene.
He does.
Where does he go?
Yes. He decides that she's to blame for all his troubles. And so he just goes off to New York City. This is after he's debt-ridden. So he sells off all of their property. I mean, down to the last sheep, pig, cow. She sees them all auctioned off.
And she has no voice in this at all?
No, not at all, because she is civilly dead, right? And she has no right to property, anything. Her husband makes the call. So he sells everything, leaving her in this empty house with nothing but her marriage bed. That's the one thing that he says, all right, that belongs to you. And he abandons her with three children, the youngest of whom it was only 2 years old at the time.
And somewhere along the line, the Shaker story starts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So talk about that.
Well, after James goes to New York City for a while and engages in all kinds of debauchery, according to Eunice. And then he decides to go to Troy, New York, near Albany, and start a business with his brother. And it's there that he came across the Shakers once more. Now, he had known the Shakers. The Shakers were among the people who would travel through Durham. And so he'd seen them, and he had religious conversations with them. But then he came to the Waterfleet Shaker Village, and he was just bowled over by all he saw, the beauty there, the stability there, the spiritual inspiration. And he decided this is how I want to live, and this is how my family should live as well.
Ah, and how my family should live.
Yes.
So he goes back to the family,
mm-hmm.
and then what happens?
Well, it's actually the Shakers who told him. I mean, left to his own devices, perhaps he would have just stayed on his own. But the Shakers said, if you want to join our society, you need to do right by your family. We cannot just let you come in and abandon your family and leave them unprotected. So there's a real irony there, because if it weren't for the Shakers, perhaps he wouldn't have come back. But the Shakers persuade him to go back to his family, and in fact they say you can't come into our society unless you do something about them. So he goes back to Eunice a year after he's abandoned her, and he says, look, I found this great people. They'll give us everything. You know, these are God's people, and they'll take care of us and our children. Let's join this world.
And she says?
Absolutely not. I mean, the last time she saw him, he was a philandering alcoholic.
And now he's coming back and saying, come, let's travel with me to paradise.
Exactly.
So she doesn't go. She's not interested.
No.
But he's not exactly going to take no for an answer here.
Exactly.
And this is where the story gets really interesting and mm-hmm. complicated and frankly ugly. Because he then what? He grabs the kids.
Yes. He, after a lot of bickering, going back and forth, he actually waits for a moment when she's not at home. I mean, she was actually visiting the Shakers, trying to shake them down, no pun intended, for some money. And he comes, the Shakers, she said, put her off there so that he could come home. And while she was on the road returning home to her children, that's when James came and put the three children, I'm sure they were screaming, in a wagon and took them away.
So they have these three kids. He's a drunk. He goes off, gets involved with the Shakers, comes back, says, come with me. She says no. She's out of the house.
Mm-hmm.
He grabs them and takes them off to the Shakers. Meanwhile, she's civilly dead, as you say. And so what does a mother do in early 1800s America when her philandering, drunken husband comes home and snatches the kids?
Well, she probably should have gone along. You know, I mean, that's what not only the law of the time, but the culture of the time demanded, that as a woman, you follow your husband in his religion, in his lifestyle, and everything. So there was legally, she had no recourse. She had no way of getting her children back. And that's one of the reasons why her case is so extraordinary, because she went against the odds when she should have just gone along or let go of her family, as many women did, and she fought.
The story, the plot thickens, as they say, as Eunice Chapman makes history, really, with her campaign. We're talking with author Ilyan Wu. She's The author of The Great Divorce, a 19th century mother's extraordinary fight against her husband, the Shakers, and her times. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. If you want to join us with a comment or a question for Ilyan Wu, you can do so at drshow@wamu.org, or you can call us at 1-800-433-8850 and become part of our conversation. Ilyan Wu, this extraordinary woman who's not going to take, you know, this kind of abuse and activity in stride, given the times, notwithstanding, then really swings into action.
Yes.
What does she start to do?
Well, she tries to take the customary path. I mean, she goes and tries to negotiate with the Shakers, and that doesn't work. She's
negotiating for what?
She says, all right, if you want some of the children, that's fine. You take one, I'll take two, or the other way around. I mean, she actually, even before that, she has her brothers-in-law offer to handle the children financially, so James has no more of that burden. And then when that doesn't work, she tries to get herself at least one of the children. And then she actually enters Shaker Society for a 2-week trial. And at that point, at the end of that trial, the Shakers say, all right, you're going to either take our religion or leave it. And she doesn't want to become a Shaker, but she doesn't want to leave her children.
Ultimately, Eunice Chapman makes history and helps to define divorce. And we'll talk about that and take your comments and questions and talk more with Ilyan Wu, the author of The Great Divorce, in just a moment. Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane. Today we're talking with Ilyan Wu. She is author of The Great Divorce, a 19th century mother's extraordinary fight against her husband, the Shakers, and her times. Ilyan Wu, she was a real brave woman, and she was charting new territory in those early years of this country, and she actually attracted the attention of Thomas Jefferson. We'll talk about that in just a moment, but again, a reminder, if you want to join our conversation, 1-800-433-8850. Ilyan, how did divorce get into this discussion that she was having, and this fight that she was having with not just the Shakers, but her husband?
Mm-hmm. Well, as we discussed, a woman, until she found a way to end her marriage, was considered civilly dead, so she was completely powerless. And Eunice needed to get a divorce in order to disengage herself from her husband. But at the same time, she needed custody of her children. And at this time, there was actually no way in New York State, I mean, no set way in the laws that allowed her to pursue custody of her children. So this is why she went to the legislature for both.
So she went to the legislature. We'll talk about that in a moment. Now, the parallel story, of course, there are about three of them here, is the Shakers themselves.
Yes.
Who were the Shakers at the time, and what was their lifestyle all about? Because that was different, too.
Yes, they were a very unusual religion. They were radical perfectionists who believed that it was possible to have a heaven on earth here and now. And that was a big comfort, I think, for people in these times, many of whom were torn about, well, how do you become saved? What are the steps towards salvation? And the prevailing Calvinist religion said, you don't know. You don't know until you're dead, and there's nothing you can do to influence your fate either way. And the Shakers believed that if you live a purely Christ-like life, which means become celibate, give up all your property, all of your worldly bonds for this sanctified way of life, you could be saved.
And James, her philandering drunken husband, believed that this was his way to earthly paradise?
He did. It seems very unlikely, but he was actually a religious man in an early period of his life. He seems to have gone sort of off the path. And Shakerism offered him, I think, a kind of both spiritual as well as material stability that he had in no other area of his life.
And why didn't Eunice want a part of this?
Well,
do we know?
Eunice, I mean, you could say that a big reason had to do with her children. In order to become a Shaker, you have to be willing to give up your husband, which would have been fine, I'm sure, your children, all of your connections to the world. And Eunice was a woman of the world who was very, very close to her children. Her children were her reason for living, and I can't imagine that she would have given them up.
What really struck me about this remarkable woman, whom mm-hmm. I'd never heard of before, and I suppose I should have, because if I were a real student of New York divorce law, we'll talk about it, she actually casts a legacy to this day.
Yes, exactly.
but you have a letter, an extraordinary letter mm-hmm. that she wrote, and I'd like to ask you to read this. You can explain first who this letter is written. It's written to another woman who's the head of the Shakers at the time. So first, give a little background as to the person to whom she is writing.
Yes, she was writing to Mother Lucy Wright, who was the leader of the Shakers at this time. The Shakers were not only founded by a woman, Anne Lee, or brought to America by an English woman named Anne Lee, but in this period, they were led by a woman who was probably one of the most powerful women in America at this time.
One of the most powerful women in America?
Yes, yes.
Because the Shaker movement is quite large?
It's large, but it also has to do, I think her power comes not just from the numbers, but from the kind of authority she had.
Influence.
Yes, this is a time when women did not enter the public arena. That's what made both Eunice Chapman unusual, I think, and in a way Mother Lucy by taking charge of the society.
So at this point, when this letter is written, mm-hmm. Eunice's kids and her husband are with the Shakers.
Yes.
Eunice was trying to get her kids back.
Yes.
And she writes to Mrs. Lucy Goodrich.
Yeah, note that she calls her by her married name.
Mrs. Lucy Goodrich.
Yes.
And the letter is dated, as you have it here, Albany, December 4th, 1817. So mm-hmm. perhaps you could read this excerpt.
Okay. So she says, Mrs. Lucy Goodrich, I now call upon you to take the matter into serious consideration and judge whether you had not better hastily restore my children and grant me some compensation for all my trouble on account of your society's abuse of me and my children and thereby prevent your complete overthrow. You know on what a foundation you stand. The sword of justice is lifted against you and you cannot sheathe it unless you comply with the above speedily. Remember that a woman can be as mighty to pull you down as a woman was to build you up.
I'm quaking in my boots here. And we got a couple hundred years on this practically. That's an extraordinary letter that she wrote.
Yes.
I love that line. Remember that a woman can be as mighty to pull you down as mm-hmm. a woman was to build you up. This is woman-to-woman stuff.
And there's a huge irony there. I mean, these two women actually had a number of parallels in their lives. Mother Lucy Wright was a very happily married young woman when her husband became infatuated with the Shaker. She was just a teenager, really. And here, this man who she loves is saying, let's give everything up. And she resisted, quite famously. But she overcame all of these resistances in order to become the supreme head of Shaker society. She's coming head-to-head with this other mother here. So in a way, you can call it a struggle of mother against mother.
And so how does Mother Lucy respond to this letter?
Well, if Eunice here is savvy in calling attention to Miss Mother Lucy's married identity, I think Mother Lucy takes this one step further. I mean, she says here, I think it would be inconsistent with law and gospel for me to try to wrest them from under the government of their father. I want no authority in such matters. She's saying, all right, I was a married woman too. And she signs her letter Lucy Goodrich.
Her married name.
Yes, her married name. But I am not usurping these roles in a way that I shouldn't. I don't want this authority. The authority lies with James Chapman, the children's father. You, Eunice, should do the same.
So she refuses to hand over the children or intercede in any way.
Well, she says that she has no... She says she doesn't know anything about the children. She says that she's innocent. She says, I can wash my hands in innocence before God and all men, respecting any abuse to thee or thy children.
So what happens with the kids?
What happens with the children? Well, I mean, for a long time, I wondered if there's any way that Mother Lucy or the other Shakers didn't know where they were. And I really wanted to find a way to make that happen. I dug through all sorts of letters and journals and looking for this evidence, and none was to be found. And quite the contrary, the children were in Enfield, New Hampshire, many, many miles away from where Eunice was all this time.
I'd like you to talk a little bit then about what happens is this whole thing. Eunice is frustrated with her any effort to talk to her husband, frustrated with any attempt to talk with or threaten or cajole or pressure Mother Lucy. So now she does something which is really extraordinary, and she goes to the state legislature, the legislature of the state of New York. Where did that idea come from, and what is she asking the state legislature to do?
Mm-hmm. Well, what she was asking for was completely unprecedented. I mean, in order, we already discussed how custody, there's no channel for her to apply for custody, and as far as divorce is concerned, the only way you could obtain a divorce at this time was to prove adultery. Prove adultery. Now, you could say that Eunice could prove adultery and move on, right? A lot of lawmakers were just throwing their hands up in the air saying, why does this woman not just go through the existing channels? She had somebody willing to testify that they saw James Chapman in a back room bed with a woman who was not his wife. That should have been, maybe that was enough. But the thing is, there was no guarantee at that time. I mean, you have all sorts of crazy testimony in this period. You have situations where, for example, a mulatto baby was born to a white couple, and even that was not always guaranteed. So, and Eunice, in her situation, would be hard pressed. I mean, at this point, the reason why divorce is so contentious is because divorce was seen as a punishment for a crime. So it's not that a divorce wasn't just about breaking up a contract. It was about fault.
What does the state legislature in New York actually end up doing?
They give her the only legislative divorce in New York history. That is the only divorce given as a direct act of legislature.
She actually won.
She did.
And did that involve just endless amounts of arm twisting and cajoling and speaking? How did this solitary woman with this remarkable story nonetheless convince a legislature full of men, right, to give her this unprecedented divorce? That's incredible.
It is incredible. And it took 3 years. I mean, it was said that she harassed the legislators day and night, would go into their room, you know, to their hotels trying to talk to them.
This was a driven woman.
Yes. I mean, she would stop at nothing. And legislators asked themselves, why are we bothering with this person? Divorce, divorce. Adultery is what would get you a divorce. And it was pointed out that the one thing that this woman had, beyond her charm and beyond her perseverance, was her writing. And her writing really hit a note with the public and with the politicians who were involved in her case.
We're talking about Eunice Chapman, a woman from 1817 who's pursuing this campaign with Ilyan Wu, who's the author of The Great Divorce, a 19th century mother's extraordinary fight against her husband, the Shakers, and her times. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane Rehm today. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-433-8850. You can write to us at drshow@wamu.org. Or track us on our Facebook and Twitter pages. We'll go to some comments in just a minute. But, Ilyan, what ultimately happens then in this very contentious family dispute? This legislature grants a divorce. Then what?
Well,
kids?
That was a big victory for her.
Right.
But it wasn't enough, because actually the children were hidden in a Shaker village in Enfield, New Hampshire. So the laws of New York didn't extend to New Hampshire. And in fact, Eunice well knew that the Shakers could move the children yet again, let's say to Kentucky or to Ohio or some other place where they had villages. So there was no guarantee.
How'd she get her kids back? Does she get her kids back?
She does, but through, I mean, when the law fails, then you turn to the violence or potential violence. So she actually rallied a mob. Hundreds of people came and circled the Shaker village in Enfield, and she took the Shakers by storm.
I would not want to be on the wrong side of it. Now, Thomas Jefferson weighs into all of this. Where's he come from?
Well, there was a lot of press coverage across the country about Eunice Chapman's case.
Can you imagine if this happened today in the cable world? And you know, I mean, we'd be having so much fun with Eunice Chapman, right?
Yeah. But at this time, you know, I mean, news didn't travel that fast.
No, it traveled painfully slowly.
Yes.
It took weeks and months for a letter to be delivered.
And it's amazing then that the word got out like this. And so Thomas Jefferson was one of these people who came across her story in the papers. He actually got a few things wrong about her case. But he was actually commenting, this is when he believed, when the legislature was due to pass Eunice Chapman's Act, and he actually believed it was a done deal. He was commenting on a very contentious previous version of this act that would have declared the Shakers, anyone joining the Shakers, civilly dead.
So what was he weighing in on? What was his point?
He thought this was absolutely horrifying.
What was horrifying?
The fact that the Shakers could be robbed of all their property, of all their custody rights, of everything. The irony here, of course, is Eunice herself, as a married woman, was civilly dead. So talk about an eye for an eye there. I mean, she had the legislature of New York seriously considering passing an act that would have done unto the Shakers as had been done unto her.
I mentioned a little earlier that Eunice Chapman's shadow is cast across, even this day, divorce law in New York. Explain that. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, we are at a pretty revolutionary point as far as divorce is concerned in New York, because no-fault divorce is expected to be signed into law here. I mean, technically, no-fault is possible, but requires a waiting period, a legal separation, and all that. So in Eunice Chapman's time, divorce was granted only on the grounds of adultery, and now there are several more criteria. But the fact that she was able to get an instantaneous divorce and without any kind of waiting period, without James Chapman's say or an involvement, without any kind of trial that would have proven that he had sinned against the marriage or committed crimes against the marriage, namely adultery, the fact that she was able to get this divorce directly and on grounds other than adultery, it's exceptional even now.
Well, let's go to a quick call here before we have to take a break. Diane from Mount Clemens, is that Michigan?
Yes.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead with your question.
You're welcome. This is an interesting discussion. The author said that when people joined the Shakers, they were required to renounce their property, give up their property. Did the Quakers get the property? And if so, could that have been a motivating factor for them not to help this mother?
Great question, Diane. Thanks. Eliane?
Yes, thank you for the question. In this case, I mean, James Chapman did not have any property to give up. Eunice claimed that he did, but he had nothing. But other people joining the Shakers customarily did bring in their property. It became part of the Shakers' larger property holdings. And there was great suspicion at this time that the Shakers were trying to indoctrinate people in order to get more property.
Property.
More
that wasn't
money.
The only thing a couple gave up when they joined the Shakers, right?
Yeah.
They took a vow of celibacy, is that
yes,
right? So
yes.
You join as a married couple and no more sex.
No more sex, no more exclusive relationship with your husband or your wife.
So it actually changes not only sexually, but it changes the relationship. They're still married, but they're not a couple any longer, I guess is what you'd say.
Well, what happened was the Shakers actually, they didn't separate the men and women. Everybody lived in the same building, but the women were the sisters, as they were called, on one side of the hall, and the brothers were on the other. So if you were a married woman, you might see your husband, you know, numerous times during the day. You just wouldn't have any exclusive connection to him.
And the Shakers today?
The Shakers today, there are three left in Maine.
That's what happens when you don't have sex, I suppose.
That's what everybody jokes about. But I think sex really, I mean, everyone who joined the Shakers knew that they'd have to give up sex. That wasn't a secret. I think for most people, more than sex, it was giving up a kind of freedom to do what they wanted to do, their independent identities. That was more of an issue.
But just three left.
Just three left, yes.
We are talking with Ilyan Wu. She is author of The Great Divorce, A 19th Century Mother's Extraordinary Fight Against Her Husband, The Shakers, and Her Times. And as we've said, her influence and her reach extend to this day. We'll talk some more about that and what she may have had to say about the state of marriage and divorce in today's society when we return. If you want to join our conversation, 1-800-433-8850 or drshow@wamu.org. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Back in just a quick minute.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
While shooting the action scenes for the new police comedy, The Other Guys, director Adam McKay stressed safety first. But the film's star, Will Ferrell, got his priorities straight.
I would then, behind Adam's back, tell everyone, don't listen to him. We got to get this shot.
Will Ferrell and Adam McKay on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today. We're speaking with Ilyan Wu. She's the author of The Great Divorce, 19th Century Mother's Extraordinary Fight Against Her Husband, The Shakers, and Her Times. And Ilyan, we had a couple of people call and ask, how do you spell your name? I think they probably want to go to their favorite website and track you down and order your book, perhaps. So I'll let you answer that.
It's spelled I-L-Y-O-N as in Nancy. W-O-O is my last name.
All right. And we're going to talk some more about this and take some calls. But while we were in the break there, we were talking. I said, you know, this would be a really interesting movie. I can sort of see these characters taking shape. And we were thinking about casting. As you think about these characters, who would you have play Mother Lucy, the head of the Shaker movement, or Eunice Chapman?
Oh, that's my favorite cocktail party question. You know, Meryl Streep, Laura Linney, there are a whole bunch of actresses in their 50s I think would make a terrific Mother Lucy.
I was just thinking, you know, Meryl Streep as Mother Lucy is sort of like the Devil Wears Prada thrown back to the early 1800s and have a religious sect on top of it. There's an email we've gotten, and actually it's a very thoughtful one. And I'd like you to comment on this because you're such a student now of the status of women and the institution of marriage in the early 1800s. This comes from Kat, and she writes, while the legal status of white women changed to that of civilly dead upon marriage. African-American women were already enslaved, not allowed to marry, their children considered the property of those who enslaved them. Please don't use the unqualified term women when you mean white women. You want to talk about that? Because it certainly is an important point.
Yes, I mean, that's certainly true. And when we were talking earlier about the Thomas Jefferson commenting on the Shakers being deprived of their civil rights.
Yeah, let's talk irony here. Huh?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a huge part of the nation that was that had no civil identity, had everything robbed from them.
The double standards and the sort of portable morality of the day is well documented, but I think it's important to
exactly.
point that out.
But one aspect of Shakerism, which I think is very positive, is that they actually admitted people of all races, and had African American Shakers in the very community that Eunice Chapman visited at the time,
which was extraordinary at the time.
They took everybody in as equals. Men and women were equal. People of different races were equal.
It was part of their utopia.
Yeah.
We have Bud, who joins us now on the phone from Indianapolis. Hi, Bud.
Hi.
Thanks for waiting.
Well, I want to thank you, Frank, for asking her to read. She is fantastic.
Thank you.
I hope that you will record that book on the commercial market, and I'm blind, and have them release it to, the Library of Congress for us. But anyway, you are fantastic. Yes, there's definitely a lot of weird church ideas out there, but you are fantastic, young lady.
Well, Bud, thank you very much for the call. Are you going to record an audiobook, or have you already?
I haven't yet. One thing that I am doing as I'm taking the book on the road is having actors and actresses give voice to these tremendous, pieces of history, including the letter, the correspondence between Mother Lucy and
Well, as we go here, if there's another passage you'd like to read, we'll come back to that and you can select that, because Bud is quite right. It was a very dramatic reading and very heartfelt. How long have you known Eunice Chapman here?
About 12 years, yes. I mean, that's when I was in graduate school and I first came across her narratives back then.
Eleanor joins us now on the phone from Little Egg Harbor, New Jersey. Hi, Eleanor.
Hello.
Go ahead with your question.
Yes, I just wanted to comment on how unfair the law was in New York State. In 1964, I was 36 years old, married 13 years, found out my husband cheated on me, and I separated and I tried to get a divorce. It took me 3 years. It took five lawyers. I had to borrow money from my relatives because I couldn't get any money to live and stay in the apartment. And I had to hire a detective. I had to become my own detective. I had to finally get information. And the fifth lawyer took him to court. And at court, I got a police officer to say, yes, the woman was living with him. And also the detective traced him to a vacation in Puerto Rico. It took me an incredible amount of time, because at that time, that 150-year-old law of adultery was the only way you could get a divorce in New York State. Now, I want to ask the author, does she know what year? Because I haven't kept track. I'm 82 now. And when the law was changed from adultery to something else.
1966, the divorce reform law.
So Eleanor missed that by just a little bit, but dealt with the legacy of that. But Eleanor brings up a really interesting point, and that is that here you are tracking this extraordinary marriage and divorce back in 1817. But I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on our definition of marriage and divorce, and the role that couples and people have toward one another. And, even up to yesterday in the court decision in California that threw out Proposition 8, we're still trying to wrap our brains about what it means when two people say, I do.
Yes, it remains an incredibly contentious issue, that's why divorce becomes such a complicated matter, because it's not just a matter, people don't look at it just as a contract between two individuals, but a social institution with much larger implications.
What would Eunice Chapman say to Eleanor, who just called in, do you suppose?
Oh, I'm sure she would have felt for her incredibly. It's really too bad that divorce reform laws were just a couple of years too late. But even then, I mean, even past that, people have had to resort to extremes in order to get around this no-fault issue in New York.
Now, what do you say, as you, again, as a student of marriage and divorce, what's your reaction to the debate that we're having in this country, and the chapter that we hit yesterday with the judge who said Proposition 8 banning same-sex marriage is unconstitutional, that people have a right to call it marriage and to engage in this form of union.
Well, on a personal level, I would agree. I believe that two individuals who love each other and want to make a lifetime commitment to one another should be able to marry, should be able to have this lifelong bond.
Back to the phones. We've got Debbie from Tennessee Colony, Texas on the phone with us. Hi, Debbie.
Hello. How are y'all? Wonderful story.
Isn't it an amazing story?
Well, I have a question. My question, when you started speaking about her writing, then you started speaking about her actually going to the legislature in New York.
Mm-hmm.
What was her education? She had to have had, she reminds me a little bit of Abigail Adams.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to be limited because you have limited me as a woman. Did her family have more of a general way of making the daughters feel okay? Because there she was, 26, before she married. And did she have an education?
Well, that's a great question. I know basically what her brother's education was like. Her more famous brother is actually Jesse Hawley, who claimed to have proposed the overland route for the Erie Canal, and he had nothing more than a country education, as he called it. He was schooled at home, and he went to the village school. So Eunice, as a woman, would have had nothing more than that, which is part of what makes her writing and all that so extraordinary. In fact, when her writing came out, people said, you know, this is a woman who is had barely any kind of education. How is it that she was able to do this? I mean, people suspected a ghostwriter of having been involved.
They just questioned her basic capabilities because she was a woman.
Yes.
Yeah. Elizabeth joins us from Center Harbor, New Hampshire. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I did want to tell you that as far as I know, though I'm on an island on a lake, so I can't get real internet. The only way I can do it is by engaging the phone. But anyway, then in Canterbury, New Hampshire, which isn't too far south of us, just north of Concord, there is a Shaker village that you can visit. It's a lovely place. And there's one Quaker left. Shaker left, I'm sorry. And there's one Shaker. And because of the internet connection, I couldn't check on it. But they just did a show on New Hampshire Public Radio about this person. So it is, there was a colony, of course, and it's largely gone now. But it's a wonderful place to visit.
It is a wonderful place. I mean, Canterbury Shaker Village was actually my very first introduction to Shakerism. I would go, my parents would bring me to these villages as a child, and that really was the one that we went to most. And I do remember seeing the last Shakeress there, Sister Ethel Hudson, but unfortunately she did pass away.
So we've heard from some other listeners, Ilian, who've asked for you to describe or explain the differences between the Shakers, the Quakers, and the Amish.
There's a lot of confusion there. I mean, because the Amish make beautiful things, the Quakers, the Shakers were actually called the Shaking Quakers, but there is no connection between them.
So what, aside from that, religiously, are there other differences between them? Are the societies in which they clustered and the rules of their social structure?
Well, neither the Amish nor the Quakers are celibate, so that's one big point of difference. The Shakers were pacifists, or are pacifists, like the Quakers, and I think this idea of spontaneous worship and communing with God directly, I think that's something that they also share.
Why were the Shakers celibate? Any group that declares celibacy mm-hmm. knows that it is creating extinction for itself.
Well, the vow of celibacy really came from Mother Ann Lee, she's known as the founding mother of the Shakers, although it started a little bit before her. She was actually a mother of 4 to 8 children, 4 by most counts, 8 by others, and none of them survived past infancy. And it was in the throes of her grief, I think, that she had joined the small group called the Shakers at the time, that she really did a lot of soul searching to figure out how to move on. And during that time, she had this vision of Adam and Eve fornicating in the Garden of Eden. And from that moment, she realized that it was that sexuality wasn't just her burden, but it was humanity's burden and the reason for man's fall. And from that, from then on, celibacy became a central part of the Shaker.
So the Shaker's existence and capacity to continue themselves depended on new members, new recruits who would take these vows of chastity and common property and giving up their property and all that kind of thing.
Exactly.
What happened? Where did the numbers fall off the charts? Why is it now a dwindling organization or sect?
Well, there are a lot of factors involved, I mean, including the decline of evangelism, I think, in the 19th century, industrialization. But one of the most interesting arguments that I've heard recently is one made by a scholar, Stephen Paderewick, and he suggests that after Mother Lucy's death, the Shakers started taking in many, many more children. Before that, they were really focusing on adult converts, and that was really the smarter thing to do. But when you start taking huge numbers of children in, they drain the society of everything, and if they don't stay on, then it's a problem. It's a difficult investment.
Question from Pat in Northampton, Massachusetts. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Thanks for this interview. It's so interesting. I'm wondering how the larger society viewed Shakers at the time, whether they were, you know, somewhat fringe or unknown or rather well-established and respected.
Well, that's a terrific question. I think, you know, in some ways the Shakers were the American, embodied a lot of these ideals that were prized at the time. I mean, they were very frugal. This was Eunice Chapman's story happens right between the War of 1812 and the Panic of 1819. America was in turmoil, fiscally and otherwise. The Shakers being having such a solid business, not taking on debts, having these beautiful ordered communities were seen in many ways as, you know, an embodiment of an American ideal. At the same time, they were seen as suspect for their sexuality. For, I mean, if you think about the fact that the life, liberty, and property were almost, you know, it wasn't almost, you know, instead of life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, communalism, communal living, and giving up all property seemed to be in some ways very anti-American.
You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today. And we're talking with Ilyan Wu. She's author of The Great Divorce, A 19th Century Mother's Extraordinary Fight Against Her Husband, the Shakers, and Her Times. Ilyan, we've had a few people who've asked whatever happened to Eunice after all of this, and I'm going to pass my copy of the book across from you because I had bracketed this passage. And since we've had a listener say you do such a great job reading this, which you do, I'd like to ask you to read that paragraph, which tells us a little bit about your protagonist here and what became of her.
Okay, I'd be happy to. As for Eunice, she became a wealthy woman in her own right. By the time she died at 85 in November 1863, she owned the house on Pineapple Street where she lived with Julia, that's her youngest daughter, plus two other properties in Buffalo, New York. She could afford to provide an annuity of $650 to Julia and still leave more to George, that's her eldest son. She succeeded, in short, in taking full advantage of the rights that her divorce had conferred upon her. She owned land, signed contracts, and benefited from the services and support of her children. The only advantage she did not exploit was the right to remarry. Eunice Chapman remained single and went by the name Mrs. Eunice Chapman until her death.
Wow. And her kids?
Her children all lived out their Shaker legacies in very different ways. And probably the most controversial would be her son, George, who, From having nearly been a celibate man, he went on to become embroiled in this big inheritance dispute, and based on the fact that he was a bigamist.
He was a bigamist.
He was a bigamist.
Well, it's one of life's little twists and turns, as we say. The plot thickens all the more. Ilyan, after all this research and studying this woman, is there something that you take away from this as you look at that society then and what she went through then and what where we stand today and what we're yelling and screaming about and experiencing today as a society? Do you connect those dots in some way?
Oh, I mean, so much of this still carries over. I mean, the controversies around marriage and divorce, the roles of women. I mean, I remember when I was writing these the legal chapters here, this was when Sarah Palin and Hillary Clinton were coming head to head, and the kinds of accusations that they faced in the media, the kinds of scrutiny. I mean, they very much echoed what I believe that Eunice Chapman faced in her times.
The role of women, glass ceiling, what people are going to accomplish, how they're recognized, still resonates. It's a story that's still being written. Ilyan Wu, thank you so much for your time today and for the book. It's called The Great Divorce, and we wish you a lot of luck with it.
Thank you so much.
Enjoyed it very much. You've been listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today. Hope you've enjoyed the conversation, and we look forward to having you join us in the future. Have a great day.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.